Welcome to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here today for our Tuesday program. You can connect with us via email at currentstate@wkar.org. Later in the hour, we've got an MSU student filmmaker who is also an Afghanistan war veteran. He collaborated with a couple of other MSU students to tell the story of his unit in Afghanistan, which was one of the hardest hit units in the history of that conflict. And he is a student here at Michigan State University, Logan Stark, a Marine Corps veteran, along with his two student colleagues, will join us to open up the second half of the program. And there's a spark of life. There's a conversation going on in Lansing's Genesee neighborhood that's been triggered by a couple of new businesses that have plans to build or revitalize along Butler Street. And we're going to talk with some people who are participating in that community discussion about the future and what they want out of Butler Street. But first this morning, a few thousand supporters of early childhood education are gathering at the state capitol today. Participants in the annual Star Power Rally will encourage state lawmakers to approve a proposed $130 million increase to the state budget for families in need. These are families who want to participate in Michigan's Great Start Readiness Program for preschoolers. Currently, the program can afford assistance only to about half of those eligible statewide. The Michigan Sandbox Party is a nonpartisan coalition involved in early childhood issues. They're organizing today's rally. Yesterday, I spoke with Sandbox Party executive and former state legislator Matt Gillard about his perspectives. I pointed out that expanded early childhood ed funding enjoys a significant level of bipartisan support from Governor Snyder to Republican State Senator Roger Kahn to many Democrats. I asked Gillard if he expects the legislature will pass a spending plan with the early childhood increase in it.
I do, Mark, and I think you're right. I mean, this is one of those rare issues in today's political world where we do see bipartisan support, and the governor deserves a lot of credit for making this one of his investment priorities. Just so we're clear, though, it's a $130 million increase over 2 years.
Okay.
So the actual increase for fiscal year 14 would be $65 million in the governor's proposal, and the Senate version that we've seen passed to this point included the $65 million as well. The House version was a little bit less than that. I think they had pegged the increase at $38 million. But we're hopeful as this, you know, as the final budget negotiations happen and as the process plays out, that we will be able to maintain a significant increase to the Great Start Readiness Program in the final budget.
How much resistance does it face, and where is that resistance coming from?
Well, you know, it does, like any issue, I think, it faces a certain level or amount of resistance. I think we have it coming from a couple different areas. The more public resistances are from maybe the more conservative groups that don't necessarily believe the science or aren't necessarily in support of government investment in these types of programs. And that's significant. But I think, you know, the governor and other leaders in the legislature are addressing that within their own ranks. Unfortunately, also meet some resistance from traditional education groups who see a limited amount of money to invest in certain areas and, you know, are reluctant or hesitant to be supportive of investment, all of the investment or significant new investment in one area where other areas may not be seeing as big of an increase. And so, you know, we're cognizant of both of those, but we're confident and hopeful that we can move forward.
One of the most compelling pieces of evidence supporting more early childhood initiatives is the Perry Preschool Study, launched here in Michigan in 1962 and updated periodically since then. Please tell our listeners about the Perry Preschool Study and what it shows.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, this is certainly, a high mark for Michigan as well. This research is used all over the world to support the benefits of investment in early childhood programs. What the Perry Study has shown over a longitudinal time, so really over 50 years now, is the dramatic impact that quality early childhood programming can have on individuals, not just in their school career, but in their lifelong career as well. So what the Perry Study basically showed, they took a group of children, divided them into two parts, one that had access to high-quality pre-K opportunities, preschool opportunities, and the other that didn't, and then have followed those children throughout their lives for 50 years now. And they've shown a dramatic increase in graduation rates and higher educational achievement initially for those children that had access to high-quality early childhood preschool experiences, but then in lifelong as well, lower incarceration rates, higher earning potential, more success through life, throughout their careers and the lives of these people. And so it really is a longitudinal study that can show the dramatic impacts, not just immediately, but long-term, that investment in early childhood programs can have for society in general.
And does any credible organization or voice dispute what the study suggests?
I haven't seen anybody that disputes what the study suggests. There are some other studies that have come out that have questioned some different early childhood programs, specific programs or specific areas where early childhood efforts have been focused. But by and large, the Perry study fits right in line with the vast majority of other research and data that's out there that shows a real significant return on investment for investment in early childhood programs and the significant impact this has on people's lives throughout them.
Is the Perry study regarded as the best, or are there others?
I think the Perry study is unique in the longitudinal, the long-term
following that it's had. Yeah.
It was groundbreaking, to their credit, to think of it and to get it underway and to continue to work on it. It really is one of its kind, and it's been unique.
The Obama administration has an initiative which could help with funding here in Michigan as well. Just last week in Ypsilanti, U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan talked about this. It's called Preschool for All. What does it propose, and what role could it play here in Michigan?
It really fits in very well with what we're trying to do here in Michigan. And Governor Snyder was at that event. I was there as well with Arne Duncan. And they both talked, speaking of bipartisanship, they both talked glowingly of the impacts and the effects of early childhood and of their respective administration's commitment to this goal. And really, the president's program would really fit very nicely, because what the president is proposing is helping states that are making the commitment to invest in quality early childhood programs. So Michigan has a renowned Great Start Readiness program. The program that's being debated about increased funding for, this Michigan's preschool program for four-year-olds here in Michigan, has multitudes of research and data that shows the effectiveness that this individual program, this specific program, has long-term. And so by expanding that, what the Obama administration is hoping is to expand the federal government's commitment to help states expand these programs. So we would be talking about further expansion of this Great Start Readiness program with federal government dollars.
Now, there is some number of citizens and some in the state legislature who appear to want as little to do with anything federal as possible. Are there enough voices in that group to hang this up?
Yes. I mean, we've been very clear in our advocacy efforts to keep our effort here, and Governor Snyder's proposal came out before President Obama's ever did, and to keep our efforts focused on what's proposed in front of the legislature right now. I think we have a real opportunity to be successful in getting an increased investment of state dollars to run this state-run program. I think the federal program is a long ways towards before it will come to fruition. I mean, certainly the president being supportive of it is great, but we have a real chance in this budget negotiation that's happening right now in Lansing to make a significant investment in early childhood programs here in Michigan.
I'm led to believe that early childhood education is evolving in terms of how best to do it, methodologies. Is that right?
Yes, I think there's consistent identified factors that impact. One of the big things that the Sandbox Party and other early childhood advocates really are focusing on is the quality of these programs. I mean, it would be a waste of money, we know, like anything else, to put money into a program that doesn't meet quality standards and doesn't have quality outcomes for the participants in the program. We have those quality outcomes and those quality standards with this Great Start Readiness program, and that's why I think we've been as successful as we are to date, and we're hoping for success in the future. Quality is very important in early childhood as it is in anything else.
But when you say quality, what are the features of a quality program?
Well, in terms of a preschool program, what we're talking about is quality is a consistent curriculum that meets the standards that have been developed by early childhood experts, that really involves parents, getting parents to as it being a part of the equation as well, or caregivers as a part of the equation as well, and really provides the foundation for children with not just educational opportunities, but the lifelong skills that they'll need to be successful in kindergarten and beyond. And it's really not—it's not just an educational program. It's really a social, emotional, health-based, and other program as well that really is all about getting the whole child ready to be successful when they reach that kindergarten door.
And is it more than what people would think of? I assume it's more than what people would think of when they hear the word daycare.
Absolutely. And so what's critical and what really I think we're starting to be more successful at here in Michigan and even around the country is getting people to understand that early childhood is not just preschool. Really what we need people – and Governor Snyder I think is very strong on this when he does speak on the issue – is that learning begins at birth. And so if we really want to talk about an educational system, an educational continuum that is in the best interest of young people, it starts with a comprehensive early childhood system really from the prenatal time for really helping pregnant females and pregnant mothers through those first stages and really through the kindergarten door. We need a comprehensive system that meets the needs of young children and their families so that we're addressing the problems that we know exist out in our society with these young children.
How does that play out in infancy? I'm really curious about that. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, I do. And really, I mean, it's parental involvement. All of these – the successful – infant programs, infant and toddler programs are based on home visiting, based on parental involvement, and really providing the resources to parents to become their child's first and best teachers in those early stages.
The organization that launched the Perry Preschool Study is called the High Scope Educational Research Foundation. It's associated with a pretty impressive preschool methodology. It takes a participatory approach to very young learners. A High Scope executive, Larry Schweinhart, cautioned last week during Secretary Duncan's visit, quote, all early childhood development programs are not created equal. What do you make of that comment?
I think Dr. Schweinhart is right on, and he's really one of the leading research experts in this field, and he is the first to talk about how quality matters. Actually, the High Scope Foundation has done the High Scope Research Institute has done the research on the Great Start Readiness Program and provided the studies that showed the success of the and really helped develop the curriculum for the Great Start Readiness Program. And so they've really, I think been a critical asset to the state of Michigan in developing our early childhood programs here, and we're lucky to have them in our state.
It appears, though, that the federal government is eager to avoid endorsing this approach or any other particular approach. What are we to make of that?
Well, I think that the federal government really wants to encourage states to get engaged in early childhood and developing early childhood programs and systems to help their citizens. And so that's why I think that the president's approach has that much promise for Michigan, because we really are, I think, at the higher end of the spectrum as far as states and our commitment and the development of early childhood programs and systems here in Michigan. And so I think what the Obama administration is trying to do or hoping to accomplish is to really encourage states to make early childhood a priority in their education systems. And states that will do that will get rewarded with federal dollars if the president's program is successful.
Any thoughts on what makes a really good preschool teacher?
I think commitment. I think it's like anything else in the education world. People that are there for the right reasons, that want to do it, that love kids and love seeing kids learn and helping kids can be great preschool teachers just like they can in anything else in the education world.
And for today's event, you're expecting how many people at the Capitol?
Over 2,000 people at the Capitol. It'll be a fun event, lots of kids. We have children's activities all over the lawn. We give our adults an opportunity to meet with their legislators, talk to them about why this issue is important to them. We'll have some gifts for the legislature, some drawings that colorings that the kids have made. It's really a fun event. We have a great time, and it's really a great opportunity for us to get together as advocates of early childhood, but also to reward and have positive conversations with the legislators to let them know that this is a priority for their constituents.
As a former state legislator, I have to ask you, Matt, what do you make of the current session? What do you make of this session that started back in January?
It's really interesting. I mean, my early childhood hat aside, I think this next month or two with these big issues surrounding the budget and how this plays out is going to be a fascinating watch for a political junkie like myself. I think the governor has, a lot at stake here in trying to get the legislature to come along with some of his ass in the budget process, not necessarily just related to the early childhood issues, but with Medicaid expansion, transportation funding, and these other things.
Besides early childhood, which I presume you might be watching more closely than anything else, what other funding issue are you keeping closest tabs on?
Well, really the Medicaid expansion issue, because that allowed – the governor's budget proposal included not just funding for the Great Start – increased funding for the Great Start Readiness Program, but also included general fund increased funding for Healthy Kids Dental, which is a great program that helps a lot of young children receive access to dental care. He increased funding for infant mortality reduction programs in his Department of Community Health budget as well. These measures are only – he was only able to do this because he called for the Medicaid expansion, which then saved, you know, roughly $200 million of general fund money for the state budget as well. So even though the Medicaid expansion issue itself wouldn't impact that many young children, we do a pretty good job in Michigan through My Child and other access programs to insure young children. But the impact that the issue will have on the general fund budget is important to early childhood advocates as well as others. And I think it's going to be fascinating politically to watch this play out.
I have to ask what you make of the infrastructure, the transportation debate as well.
You know, I think it's as a former Democratic legislator, I think it's a huge opportunity that the Democrats in the legislature have, being in the minority, to really impact a significant issue. And so I would love to see a comprehensive bipartisan package worked out. I'm not holding my breath that it's going to happen. But I think it's a real opportunity for the governor to show some leadership and for the legislative leaders on both sides of the aisle to come together and both put some skin in the game and come up with a comprehensive package that makes sense and works for Michigan citizens. This is an issue that we were debating back when I was in the legislature, which seems like eons ago, but something that needs to be addressed.
Matt Gillard is policy coordinator for the Sandbox Party. He's going to be at the state capitol today at the Star Power Rally. Matt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. 10,000 years ago, glaciers carved out the Great Lakes. To this day, ice influences the Great Lakes Basin's culture, economy, recreation, and its people. The film Project Ice depicts the important role ice plays in the Great Lakes region. Bill Kleinert, the documentary's executive producer and director, joins us to discuss Project Ice. Hi, Bill Kleinert.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for joining us. This project started out with a very different angle 2 years ago as a film looking at the car ferries that traverse the Straits of Mackinac. How did that film evolve into something exploring the entire Great Lakes region?
Well, my writing partner, Brian Jeske, who is the Registrar of Historic Collections at the Mackinac State Historic Parks, he's really the foremost expert in the car ferries at the Straits, and he and I have been talking over the previous roughly 5 years or so about doing a project together, and that seemed like a portion of Michigan history and Great Lakes and maritime history that really hadn't been explored. So we started exchanging outlines, and as we went through that process, my outlines started growing. And there were other aspects of the Great Lakes development that I thought that we should include. And so it just grew, and it became a broader kind of picture of how they really tell us things about ourselves beyond just the Great Lakes, but about the entire North American experience. And we've had the good fortune to visit a lot of really, really interesting places and take people with our cameras behind the scenes of some things that they probably wouldn't have opportunity to see otherwise.
Yeah. Let's talk about those. I mean, we typically think about ice in the ways that it's shaped the Great Lakes geographically and maybe environmentally, but your film goes farther. You look at how ice has shaped the region's culture. Tell us about that.
Sure. Even starting back with Native American culture 8 to 14,000 years ago, ice was a critical factor in their seasonal activities. So it goes way back. And then as European explorers started coming to the region, then obviously ice impacted when they could travel, where they could travel, how they would travel, and they were forced to deal with the ice. As settlements began, they too were forced to deal with the ice. It impacted when they might receive goods by boat. St. Ignace was a perfect example that until the car ferries at the Straits came about, St. Ignace was basically cut off from mail delivery and packages and other things that would come to them during the winter that had to cease for a period of months. And of course, at that time, ice cover was a more prolonged period of time. So they were cut off for a substantial portion of the winter. When the car ferries came about, they were able to negotiate the ice in the Straits, which was is some of the most challenging in all of the Great Lakes. So that really changed things for them. They suddenly had access to things that they didn't previously have access to. And that's in about the 1880s, 1881, when the Michigan Transportation Company came about at the Straits. And this was a car ferry service. And when we say car ferry in this context, it's important for listeners to realize that these ferries came about before there were automobiles. We're talking the 1880s. And so the cars being referred to were rail cars at that time.
I see. Okay, yes. That's a good detail to point out.
Yeah.
I can't help but flash on the account of how Moose came to Isle Royale because of an exceptionally cold winter one year. Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I think I've got this story right. But Moose came to be native on Isle Royale because of an unusually cold winter one year, and they were able to travel all the way across the ice from Canada onto Isle Royale. So, I mean, it's quite a profound environmental impact there.
Indeed, indeed. And other, we've seen examples, firsthand examples of other animals traversing the ice. We were shooting at the Sioux Locks in 2011 on the night of March 25th. The locks typically open at midnight on approximately that date. And we were there shooting, and it was very cold. It was 17 below zero that night. And we had six cameras rolling that evening. And all of a sudden, we looked up, and here is a fox going across the ice from Canada to the United States. And it told us that this is definitely a part of nature's activity, that animals were able to get places via the ice that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I'm sure that fox probably aren't great swimmers. So
that's a great story. What I find really interesting in this film is the contrast between these large scale pictures of mm-hmm. these gigantic impressive lakes put next to these intimate portraits of people and how they are connected to ice. Was it important to you to look at ice's impact in that personal way?
Very much so. All along, we wanted this to be a story of people. I think that and climate change kept coming up in the 25 interviews that we did. It kept coming up over and over and over again with surprising frequency and in surprisingly detailed and intimate ways. And so this became a real a critical portion of our story. I'd always envisioned that we were going to have science as an important portion of the story. But as that came up from people as diverse as those putting on the pond hockey tournament at the Straits at St. Ignace, or people putting on the UP 200 dog sled race, or people aboard the Coast Guard cutter Mackinac, where we did a couple days of ice breaking with them on Lake Superior and on the St. Mary's River. This just kept coming up over and over again, how the ice cover is changing. And so as we explored this with several scientists, we realized that this is a critical part of the story that needs to get out. And then I was introduced to Dr. Henry Pollack, who is a geophysicist and climatologist and professor at University of Michigan, and he shares the 2007 Nobel Peace Prize with Al Gore, and he became our science advisor on the project, and he's one of the foremost experts in the world on climate change. So it was great to have a Michigan person who could relate directly to what's going on with ice cover on the Great Lakes and how it's affecting so many different activities, from ice fishing to hockey, to dog sled races, to snowmobiling, and even the ice bridge that has traditionally existed most winters going out to Mackinac Island. We actually weren't able to shoot it either year that we were up there, because it didn't exist at that point. There was not sufficient ice cover for the ice bridge that they use for a period of, well, it used to be for a period of months, and now if they're lucky, it's for a period of weeks to get back and forth from St. Ignace out to Mackinac Island. So they have to fly.
Who's the most interesting character, the most interesting ice fisherman, hockey player, ice climber that you met in the making of this film?
We met so many different, very, very interesting people. We met a gentleman who had lived on Nebish Island, which is one of the largest islands in the St. Mary's River. That's the river that, of course, that connects Lake Superior with Lake Huron. And he'd lived out there for, 50, 60, 70 years. He was a real character. But we met hockey players at the pond hockey tournament in St. Ignace, the annual UP Pond Hockey Championship tournament, who were just fantastic. We spent 2 days aboard the Coast Guard cutter Mackinac and got to know the captain very well. Much of the crew aboard the Mackinac, who just couldn't have been more accommodating to our filming needs. We just had some really interesting experience. I guess one of the most interesting was going to the top of the Mackinac Bridge, which is, of course, 585 feet above the water, the waters of Lake of the Straits down below. And that is an adventure in and of itself, to get up through the labyrinth innards of the bridge and up to the top, and you have this just, oh my gosh, moment when you come through the final hatch at that 585-foot level up there, and you take in this just incredible view. And get our 1,000 pounds of gear up there with us was quite an experience. You have ladders of 40, 60 feet that you have to traverse inside there and haul your equipment up as well. So
wow,
that was quite an experience.
You are,
and if you go across the Mackinac Bridge sometime, look at the bridge towers. Look at the side of them as you go by, and you'll see these small little hatch covers that you have to go through, little companionway covers that you have to go through. And I'm a pretty big guy. I'm 6'2" and about 220. And I went, how am I going to get through there? But I did. We went through probably 20 of those inside the bridge. So was really interesting.
Just don't look at those if you're driving the car.
No.
You can do that
if
you're
a
passenger.
Slow way down.
Bill Kleinert is the executive producer and director of the film Project Ice. Bill Kleinert, best of luck with the movie. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Really appreciate being on your show.
Sure. This Tuesday Current State segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks very much for joining us. In 2010, the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment deployed to Sangin, Afghanistan. Nicknamed the Dark Horse Battalion, the 3-5 was sent to patrol a region of the country known as a Taliban refuge and a center for the opium trade. During the deployment, the 3-5 achieved a somber record. That single unit suffered the highest casualty rate of any in the Marine Corps. One Marine who made it home was Logan Stark. He documented his experience and those of his fellow Marines in a new film called For the 25, named in tribute to his 25 comrades who were killed in action. Stark is in the professional writing program at Michigan State University. He joins me now in the studio to talk about the film, along with two of the film's co-producers, MSU students Lexi Dakin and Rebecca Zancher. Welcome, Logan, Lexi, and Rebecca to Current State.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Logan, you deployed to Afghanistan as part of the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment, the Dark Horse Battalion, as we pointed out. Your unit was assigned to a particularly dangerous area of the country where the Taliban had this stronghold. What was your unit's mission, and what was yours specifically?
I was in the Scout Sniper Platoon, and we were attached to the infantry companies that were stationed throughout the Sangin area. And basically, we were tasked with going to the different areas in that region and extinguishing the Taliban.
Okay. You were a sniper.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you worked with a bunch of other snipers.
Correct.
As well. Okay. Your documentary is called For the 25. It's dedicated to the 25 Marines from the 3-5 who were killed in action. At what point did you begin documenting your experience in Afghanistan?
Well, it really happened from the beginning. A lot of my friends had helmet cams or cameras attached to their weapons or just their cameras. It was that we knew going in that it wasn't going to be an experience that we wanted to document.
A really profound visual experience.
Correct.
Yeah. And so that's common? Is that common for service people in Afghanistan to do a lot of video?
I think it is today with the advances in different camera equipment and whatnot. It's very simple and affordable to be able to do that, and it's pretty easy to do.
And when did you transition, though, from just random video to the idea of making a film?
It started last year when I was taking a journalism class, and the professor wanted the class to do a video project, and the only requirement was that it was an interesting story, and I couldn't think of a more—
You had one of those.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And to do video on my roommate Kevin, who is also one of my best friends, and that was what really got the ball rolling. And then when the three of us sat down this past semester to decide what we wanted to do for a semester-long project, I showed them that video, and then it kind of took off from there.
Okay, so Lexi and Rebecca, you learned an awful lot about Afghanistan in the process of this.
Yeah.
Lexi, tell what did you learn? What was your responsibility in the making of the film?
I learned a ton about the Marines as a unit and just the types of difficulties these soldiers had to deal with. For the most part, I was in post-production with the video, doing edits and creating the story that we made.
Was that here in Comm Arts?
That in the professional writing program.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's elsewhere. I assume everything happens here in the Comm Arts building, right? What about you, Rebecca?
I think one of me and Lexi's greatest roles was as outside parties. We're not members of the Marines. We haven't had those experiences. We want to help create a story that would speak not just to Marines but to people like us.
Yeah.
Want a story that was accessible to more than just Marines but also to families of Marine veterans and also just to everyday people who have no connection.
We're talking with filmmaker Logan Stark and Lexi Dakin and Rebecca Zancher, who have created a movie called For the 25, which is a tribute to Logan Stark's comrades from the Marine Corps and their very dangerous mission as members of the Dark Horse Battalion. We've got a clip from For the 25 here. It opens with what's obviously a combat scene. Then we hear from one of your comrades, Corporal Jordan Laird. He's explaining the dire circumstances your unit endured. Let's listen.
And we were so short on bodies that we were begging the Marine Corps to send us Marines to help us. We had 25 KIA plus over 200 wounded.
Logan, can you comment about what we just heard there? That was with Corporal Jordan Laird. Is that a typical segment in this movie? It's just soldiers recollecting their experiences.
Yeah, that's correct. all throughout the film, and it kind of starts with how we came together, and then it works into the experiences that we had while we were in Afghanistan, and then touches on what it was like for us coming back. But throughout that middle part of the film, that's pretty standard for us to show footage and then talk about it.
That and Corporal Laird mentions the 25 KIA. Is that a reference to the 25 killed in action here after your shooting was all done?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. What was unexpectedly difficult about putting this movie together? What was a challenge that you didn't anticipate?
Just having to relive those moments.
Yeah, it was an emotional thing more than a technical thing.
Absolutely. So. It was really hard to ask my brothers to sit down and to relive those when it causes so much pain. But as it turned out, it proved to be incredibly healing for everybody involved in the project.
So would you say that was the most rewarding aspect of this thing? Was that it was part of a healing process as well?
Absolutely.
Lexi, what was it like to witness some of these really emotional disclosures?
It was hard watching Logan go through that and watching the interviews of the other men that went through it. I can't even imagine how that must have felt, but it was seeing the comments made after people watched our video is fantastic to see that they've come together with former Marines and their families and everything. It's just so rewarding.
It's so easy to forget that as MSU students or college students anywhere, that you rub shoulders with these veterans,
yeah,
who have been through these mm-hmm. extraordinary experiences. Anything to say about that, Rebecca?
Yeah, I mean, I knew when I first found out that Logan was a Marine. That was a big moment in our friendship, just to know like what he'd been through. And there's a moment in the film, too, when one of the characters is talking about, throughout the film, he's been portrayed as this very masculine warrior type personality, and then he reveals that he's now working at T-Mobile selling phones to people. And that moment for me was a huge turning point in the way I saw this film, is that everyone has a story, and you never know who that guy selling you your phone or cutting your hair or serving your food, what he might have been through. And that was a big part of this film too.
Logan, I'm so tempted to ask you about the movies that have been made, the Zero Dark 30 movie. I'm drawing a blank on the other movie by the same filmmaker about Iraq.
Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker, of course. What have you seen those movies, and what's it been like to watch either of those movies or both of them?
I have seen both of those movies, and they're movies. What I've really enjoyed about making our movie is that, you know, I know about all of the footage that was in our film. It was from people I know. And that I was able to communicate that to the viewers, I think.
Yeah.
And it wasn't produced.
Sure.
It was actually there. And I think that's what separates
this
us.
This is a documentary.
Correct.
No question about it. So, but still, I asked the question, I guess, because so many Americans have been exposed to the war through those two movies. I had to get your take. Another one of your friends in the film is Corporal Kevin Frame, who I believe you mentioned a minute ago. At one point, the two of you talk about the day Kevin was actually shot in the head. Then later, fortunately, Kevin reflects on what that meant to him. Let's listen.
Definitely got a second chance, you know, got to push the restart button kind of. And then it was like, that's when I was completely changed. I was like, dude, it's on, you know, and it's kind of a fight every single day just to make sure you get out of there, you know.
Pretty dramatic stuff. Is PTSD a common affliction amongst the people you've served with?
I think so.
Yeah.
I don't think it's really talked about that much, but I think it is, yeah.
Okay. Do you have PTSD?
Yes.
Okay. What? Tell us a little bit more about the transition back to civilian life. You came back when, and did you go straight to Michigan State here then, or what?
I got back from Afghanistan in April of 2011. And I got out of the Marine Corps July of that summer, and then started going to Michigan State in August. So it was a very quick transition for me.
Yeah. What was that like? I mean, was it tough? Was it just surreal? How was it?
It's really hard to describe, but it was a total 180.
Yeah.
To go from what I had been doing and then to go to a school where I'm older and I don't know a lot of people. It definitely took a little while to reintegrate.
There is that dramatic scene in the Hurt Locker where he finds himself back in the aisles of a grocery store. I mean, he's gone from this intense, emotional, dramatic life and death situation, and he's in the midst of a middle class, the cereal aisle at the Meijer or whatever, and it just really captured that moment. And what a challenge that must be like. What kind of reception has the documentary received so far, Logan?
It's really been incredible. I get calls and messages and emails, and people are they're just thinking and talking to family members. They're just very grateful, not only to see those men again, but just to know a little bit more about what they went through. And that has by far been the most rewarding point.
Lexi and Rebecca, has being exposed to this project changed your discussions about war or the war in Iraq or war in general with the people that you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I imagine it would. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think the biggest part of this project, before I made this movie, I knew that they were soldiers, but I didn't know any of them, and I thought they were kind of this separate race of people that I could never understand. But making this movie was in large part about making sure that soldiers are still people and they're still men, and that their stories are incredible and there are parts I will never understand. But there's also so much about them I can understand, and that was a big part of this project for me.
Lexi, anything to add to that?
Yeah, well, my dad is actually a military man. He's in the Army, so I have some military exposure, but this video still, I learned so much, and I realized, like Rebecca said, there's so much you don't know about these people, and there's so much they've been through that you are really exposed to in this film.
Where can people see For the 25? How can they see it?
Right now it's living on YouTube under For the 25, and then you search my name, Logan Stark, and then it comes up.
YouTube For the 25. Are you a Michigan guy?
I am.
Okay, where are you from?
Greenville, originally.
Greenville, Michigan. Okay,
yep.
Good. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you all in here. We've been talking with filmmaker Logan Stark. His documentary about his experience in Afghanistan and the guys he served with is called For the 25. It lives on YouTube. Also, two of the film's co-producers, both MSU students, all three of these folks are MSU students, Lexi Dakin and Rebecca Zancher. Thank you all very much, and good luck with the movie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current state here on 90.5 WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Two planned projects in Lansing's Genesee neighborhood have triggered a forward-looking discussion among residents and business people there. Earlier this year, within just a few weeks, in fact, the Michigan Association of Broadcasters and the nonprofit Zero Day announced plans for new offices and facilities on Butler Street, all of which runs less than a half mile. The organizations then reached out to area residents and businesses for input on what they want out of the area. A group calling itself the Butler Corridor Coalition was the result. Its first meeting was last Saturday, and here to talk about what's getting talked about, a leader of the coalition, Rory Nooner, works for the Westside Commercial Association. Hi, Rory.
Good morning.
And we welcome Carol White, CEO of the Michigan Broadcasters Association, who is behind one of the two planned projects. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm real good. Thanks for coming in. Rory, remind our listeners where Butler Street in Lansing is.
So Butler Street runs north to south. It's within walking distance of downtown Lansing, and it's a short street that dead ends into Ottawa. So if you're over there by the Hall of Justice, that's kind of where it starts and then runs north up to the Saginaw Corridor.
And Carol White, briefly tell us about these plans by your group, the Michigan Association of Broadcasters.
Well, we had an opportunity to buy this land just sort of unexpectedly.
This is not a building. This,
no,
is, just
this is just
vacant
just
land.
Vacant land. There are about five houses on this parcel. Parcel is 5 acres, and the homes are individually owned, and whatever we would do, we will work around those homes. Where we are doing all the research and tentatively planning on building our building would be right at the corner of Ottawa and Sycamore.
Okay.
We're just outgrowing our current building. We have to count on that about a third of the board members won't show up, or else they'll have to stand because there's no more room in the boardroom at the MAB. And with the changing needs of the broadcasting industry and how the broadcasting industry are really media outlets rather than just broadcasters anymore, we need a new home for the MAB that will afford us the space and the opportunities to expand into all the exciting new media that broadcasters have embraced.
So your designs on that area of Butler Street and Zero Days designs on the other end of Butler Street led to this gathering of people. Both of these organizations reached out to residents and businesses in the neighborhood. How did you do that and why?
Well, I have personally have a long history in working with neighborhood groups and historic groups. My husband and I refurbish Victorian homes for fun and games. We're living in our fifth one.
Wow.
And we're part of a neighborhood group in the Grand Ledge area. And so the very first thing we wanted to do is we looked at what other developers had done when they owned the property. And the gap was they were not talking with the community. We want to build something in that area. If everything keeps going swell, you know how that goes. Any kind of a hiccup can put things on hold. But as things move out, we wanted to speak with the community, get their vision for the area, let them get to know us a little bit, know that whatever we do, we would do it to fit into the area, not to dominate the area. And so I reached out to the neighborhood organization.
And so Rory Nooner, the Butler Corridor Coalition, was formed, and there was a session last Saturday. What happened at that session?
Well, the session was put on. The Corridor Coalition is a partnership between the Downtown Neighborhood Association, the Genesee Neighborhood Association, and the Westside Commercial Association. So after we'd spoken with Carol and the folks from Zero Day, we put this session together last Saturday, and we were delighted that over 40 folks, whether they own a house in the neighborhood or are renters in the neighborhood or own a business, showed up to come together to talk about what things they want to see. So we used the kind of idea of preserve, enhance, and transform, which, you know, in some urban planning circles is a kind of good way of thinking about what are the things we love about our neighborhood now that we want to keep. What are the things that we think just need a little work? We want to enhance. We want to make them look a little bit different. And then what are the things that really need a whole lot of attention, that really need to be transformed into something new and something that's going to work for the neighborhood now?
How detailed did the discussions get last Saturday?
We divided folks up into different table topics. So we had folks talking about transportation and connectivity. We had folks talking about parks and recreation. We had people talking about what we called kind of curb appeal of how things, you know, how houses look, how businesses look. And so people got really detailed. You know, they had specific pothole complaints, or they said, you know, this corner of Ferris Park looks great. And so it was both a conversation about these development projects and this opportunity around the development projects, as well as the neighborhood from a larger perspective.
Was there a pattern to the topics, though? I mean, did a topic or two recur often enough that it's clearly a high priority of the neighborhood?
I think for each of the neighborhood organizations that were involved, and for example, I work with the Westside Commercial Association, and a lot of folks said that we focus on Saginaw Street. And the area near Butler and Saginaw, there's a certain portion of Saginaw Street people think there's a lot of potential around. We heard that over and over again, that there are some historic storefronts along Saginaw Street that, as we're paying more attention to the neighborhood and thinking about ways to kind of catalyze, use these development projects as catalysts for improvements, that that's what we should be focusing on. And I think for the Downtown Neighborhood Association, they heard a lot of talk about Ferris Park. Ferris Park's a lovely park, could be a real opportunity. People talked about Ottawa Street, so where the MAB site will go. Are there ways to slow Ottawa Street down a little bit, make it more walkable, make it more friendly for pedestrians?
We should also point out that, as I understand it at least, correct me if I'm wrong, but Butler Street was not really the only area here. You drew a radius of a third of a mile from Butler in every direction and really tried to include all those people and businesses in this?
We did. So we thought a third of a mile is a good indicator of about how far people are willing to walk. So that's about a 10-12 minute walk, depending on how quick you are. And we use that as an organizing tool instead of using our usual boundaries. So, for example, Martin Luther King tends to divide some of our thoughts about the neighborhoods over there. But I live across the other side of MLK, and the Genesee Street School, for example, is a 5-minute walk from where I live. So why is there this boundary there? So we thought we use this third of a mile as kind of arbitrary, but in terms of the amount of time it takes to walk, let's kind of try to redefine the neighborhood in a new way.
What's next? Do you have another meeting planned? I presume you do.
Well, I know Carol and the folks at MAB, as well as the folks at Zero Day, are moving forward with their development projects. The Butler Corridor Coalition, our planning team will get together Thursday morning, compile all of our notes. We're going to put out a report based on all the feedback that we got. We're going to publish on our website and give folks a 30-day comment period, and then send it off to the city, to MAB, to Zero Day, and let people take a look at what we came up with.
We'll be keeping an eye on it. Carol White of the Michigan Association of Broadcasters and Rory Nooner of the Westside Commercial Association, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we look at some of the legal barriers facing entrepreneurs in Michigan, and what can we learn about the possibility of life on Mars from meteorites. Find out all of that Wednesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worth. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry and Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.